You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Akwe Amosu, OSI's Senior Policy Analyst on Africa in Washington, D.C., and just up here for this meeting. It's really a great pleasure to welcome you all. Thank you for making the effort to be here. It's obviously a hugely important subject, so I know you're not just here for the wine. Before I start, I'm asked to inform you that we are recording this event, as we do all OSI events, and we may make available portions of it on our website. I'm therefore asking people to use the microphones, both panelists. Make sure you're up close, and for people who come and ask questions or make comments, to also make sure they do so from the microphone. I'm also asked to inform you of the nearest emergency exit, she said, looking carefully around to see if she knew where it was. There is one there, there's one there, and obviously there's the door out onto the back, and the way you came in, so no shortage in case of a need. Once again, we're at a crossroads with Zimbabwe. I think those of us who, not long after March this time last year, when the prayer meeting was hit so hard and many of the political leaders targeted and tortured, we had a meeting in here, and I'm having a slight sense of deja vu. However, I think it would be true to say that we also sense that this is not just another crackdown without any opportunity or space. We see some glimmer of possibility. And thinking about why that was, I reflected that although Zimbabwe has a history of stolen elections, this time we actually know what people voted. And I think it's useful just to briefly reflect on why that is. A lot of us were incredibly skeptical about the value of even holding an election in these conditions. And I think what there's a lesson to be learned here, which is to look closely at what has changed. Quite small changes can make a difference. The SADC region has an electoral standard, and all the countries in the region, except for Swaziland, adhere to this particular clause of the standard that votes should be counted at the polling station at the local level and the results should be posted at the local level. I think we have that single clause to thank for knowing that the MDC won the parliamentary election. And I think it threw the ruling party, ZANU-PF, right onto the back foot. I think they probably didn't realize just how important and critical that clause was. So we saw the parliamentary result released, and we saw the Senate result released. I think at that point, the authorities bethought themselves and realized that this was not going in the direction that they wanted to go, and that they needed to think again about how they wanted to handle it. The very fact that they did that, and they decided not to announce the presidential vote, for most of us suggests that either the leader of the MDC won that vote outright or he won it with something short of 50%, but with a clear majority. Otherwise, it's very, very hard to explain why they didn't announce the results. And since a majority would automatically have triggered a second round, it's mystifying why the ruling party felt they had to have a day-long Politburo meeting to discuss it, whether they would be willing to go into a second round, a point which caused some people to think that he did win it outright. But we, of course, cannot know what the outcome was. What I think is absolutely critical is that those results should be released. And I think what we want to do today is ask these excellent panelists to set out for us the situation on the ground, the current human rights situation, which has been sadly neglected, by the authorities in the region, and to look at some of the policy options that are available at this point, to try and understand where this situation might be headed and whether indeed there is an exit point. We are right to think that there's a glimmer of light at the end of this tunnel. So I think the best thing for me to do is to just introduce the panelists as we go. Quick note that I'm afraid I will have to leave right near the end in order to catch a train, and at that point I will hand over to Georgette to finish off the meeting, but we'll see how far we go. Maybe we'll be ending at that point anyway. So, to my right, I have Otto Saki. He's a Zimbabwean lawyer and a current human rights fellow at Columbia Law School. He previously served as the acting director of Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights, an extraordinary organization, enormous courage, and has worked to defend human rights and opposition activists in Zimbabwean courts. He's also the winner in 2006 of the Reebok Human Rights Award. I'm going to ask Otto to kick off for us by giving a situation report on the ground, and I'll ask him to come back at the end and give us a sense of what he thinks needs to be done from outside Zimbabwe to help move the situation forward. Otto, thank you.
Thanks, Akwe. I think everyone is virtually abreast with some of the current developments in Zimbabwe. I'll try to speak to, I think, some of the critical developments that might be of interest, and also the developments around the region which have happened in the past few days. The first, that Zimbabwe became really a cause for concern for the SADC region, which is the Southern African Development Community, was following the 11th of March 2007, when civil society and the opposition had organized a prayer rally in one of the high-density suburbs. The response then by the regime was to go out full force, violently dispersing the gathering and resulting in the death of one of the activists then. It also, I think, attracted international attention insofar as we saw the leadership of the opposition being, you know, brutally beaten, being hospitalized, among other things. Following the meeting that had been disrupted, the SADC heads of state thought of having an extraordinary summit, which was held in Arusha, called by the president of Tanzania, who was then the chairperson of the SADC organ on defense and politics. The resolution of that meeting was to appoint or to nominate South Africa, is headed by Thabo Mbeki, to be a mediator or a facilitator of a dialogue between the ruling party and the opposition. I think then was the indications that for the first time there's been a recognition or the acceptance of the opposition as a critical factor in the Zimbabwean politics. The outcomes of the mediation actually remain virtually disputed insofar as at present, we are yet to have, you know, the results of the presidential elections being announced, of which, in our view, and in the view of civil society, and even I think in the opposition political party, the mandate of the mediator is yet to be completed. For as long as we are yet to get the results, and also get an undisputed outcome of the results, then I think he still has got a role to play, and should be seen to be doing that. Following again the efforts of the mediation, there had been quite a number of repeal of some of the legislations that kind of opened up the environment, though they might have been cosmetic insofar as the implementation of those legislations remained very much, you know, in doubt. Some of the laws that were amended relate to the security laws, the Public Order and Security Act, which relates to the ability of organizations, political parties, to assemble without having to go through the processes of notifying the police, or in the event of notifying, having to then appeal again to the same police for permission, as it were. Opening up of the airwaves, giving the opposition an opportunity for the first time, you know, to be heard, playing their campaign jingles on the national television and the radio stations, which had never been heard, you know, before. Though the time that had been accorded even to the opposition virtually remains limited. That's the background to which you know, Zimbabwe went into the 29th of March election. After the polling, there was an endorsement of the outcome I think, by the SADC observer mission headed by the Angolan Foreign Affairs Minister, who said the conditions in the country were conducive for a free and fair election, and virtually gave the election up to the end of the polling, you know, a green light. The same was of the observer mission from the African Union, headed by the former Sierra Leonean president. But in our view, that remains contested, whether indeed we have had a free and fair election, despite the fact that for the first time, the opposition seems to have, you know, obtained seemingly a majority in the House of Assembly, but also a shared victory in the upper house. That, you know, is predicated on the basis of our concerns prior to the polling period, insofar as the environment remained virtually heavily skewed against the opposition. Be that as it may, we then saw again, you know, the heads of state led by the Zambian president, Levingwana Wasa, who, if you may recall, in 2007 had likened Zimbabwe to a sinking Titanic, and really had got strong responses from the Zimbabwean president, who even had to walk out at one of the summits in protest of those sentiments, again calling for another extraordinary urgent meeting on Zimbabwe, which was attended, I think, by about 8 heads of states who were in attendance, and some sent in their dignitaries. Again, the issue was Zimbabwe. Of concern, I think, and the outcome of the summit is the watered-down statement that came out. We know they were debating around semantics of whether to call the situation in Zimbabwe a crisis or not. And the good mediator before he arrived in Zambia had made a stopover in Zimbabwe. We are not so privy of what the deliberations had been, but he has really been trying to tread a fine line, you know, to be seen to be neutral, but he seems to have successfully failed, in my view, to be neutral and independent in his mediation efforts. The communique, again, from the SADC heads of state meeting over the last weekend failed to address some of the concerns, I think some of the panelists who raised that, around the human rights violations. Reports that we've received to date and attendance that we've made in the organization that I work with, about 157 individuals have actually been attended to in cases of torture, being beaten up, and 30 are still in hospitalized with several and differing injuries, all sustained from beatings. The ruling party has again reconstituted the war veterans, but I think the war veterans are actually being abused as a term, because assuming they are all veterans, right now they will be in their 60s and 70s if they are the ones who genuinely fought the liberation struggle. So we have the youth militia being co-opted, you know, and led by individuals in the army, the intelligence, and police, and going out identifying pockets of resistance in the rural areas, or individuals that are alleged or perceived to have been, you know, or have voted for the opposition and been beaten up. We also have the situation of our judiciary, which is severely compromised, for lack of a better word or explanation to it, that seems to have cast a veneer of legality insofar as all the constitutional and legislative manipulations that the ruling party, in conjunction or with the support of the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, has been, you know, undertaking in the past few weeks. So 15 days on the dot after Zimbabweans went to the election to elect the president, the House of Assembly, and the local council, we are yet to get an outcome of the elections. I'll end there so that at least I can give colleagues an opportunity to speak. Thanks.
Thank you, Otto. We're going next to Georgette Gagnon. She's an international human rights lawyer and director of the Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. She leads a team of researchers who do fact-finding investigations and advocacy on human rights abuses in 23 countries in sub-Saharan Africa, and they've done very, very valuable work in Zimbabwe. Ms. Gagnon was previously the deputy director of the Africa Division of Human Rights Watch and has held the post of director of human rights for the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe in the mission to Bosnia and Herzegovina, based in Sarajevo, and she's also served with the United Nations in Afghanistan, Bosnia and Herzegovina, and Rwanda. Thank you, Georgette.
Thanks. Is this on?
I think so, but pull it closer to so we can hear you.
Thank you very much. Human Rights Watch has been on the ground in Zimbabwe for about the past 4 years now, and we've had the the same researcher, luckily, working on Zimbabwe all this time. So we have developed very good contacts on the ground. We're producing reports and working very closely with our colleagues at Zim Lawyers for Human Rights on a daily basis. In fact, they've bailed us out of some sticky situations in certain parts of Zimbabwe. So we're very grateful for their support and collaboration. The human rights situation, as some of you may know, in Zimbabwe is and has been appalling and a complete disaster. The government continues to repress all manner of political opposition, students groups, teachers, any person or group who they consider to be in opposition to the ruling party. This election was simply quite the same as the previous elections. In fact, we called our report that we put out on the elections on March 19th all over again. Human rights abuses and flawed electoral processes in Zimbabwe, which is sitting outside. And as Otto said, in spite of some improvements to electoral laws, which would have only happened with pressure from Zim lawyers and others, the election was still not held in a way that was fully free and fair. But in spite of that, you know, it's quite clear that the result isn't what the ruling party would have wanted. I don't want to go into a lot of discussion about past human rights abuses, which we've laid out in many of our reports. Let me just say that one very serious situation occurred a few years ago, which still has not been addressed and just shows the level of impunity across the country and the continuing ability of the ruling party, its supporters, the police, the army and state security to do what it wants. Is you may recall that a few years ago the government evicted huge amounts of people, thousands and thousands of people from various areas in Harare and other places. And they actually called this Operation Cleanse the Filth. And filth is people. And that situation has never been resolved. Many, many thousands of those people are still living homeless in Harare on the run, or they've been shipped out to the rural areas where there is a real problem with access to food, medical care, and other things. This situation was never dealt with properly, and it remains a real stain on the, you know, the human rights record of the government. In the wake of the election, and as you know, the presidential results still have not been announced, we are very concerned that the human rights situation will deteriorate. It is at this point, though, and I think Otto would agree, we are still at a point where appropriate advocacy and action can prevent a huge deterioration. We think there's still things that can be done, and this is where all our advocacy needs to be focused. The reports we're getting is that there are sporadic incidents of violence across the country, particularly in the rural areas and in those constituencies that voted for the MDC. And in fact, one sinister turn that was taken is that when, you know, the polling results were posted, as was said, which was seen as a very positive feature, a big change, but now they're being used to go after people, to go after those who voted for the opposition. So that is not a good consequence of what has been happening. It is unclear at this point exactly what the level and extent of violence is across the country, because many independent researchers, journalists, and others cannot get into certain areas. Access is still being restricted. So the reports that we're getting are from small groups of NGOs on the ground who are able to work with some of the victims. We think it's probably in greater numbers than what has been reported, and Our concern is that if and when these results are announced, depending on which way they go, as we said, the situation will rapidly deteriorate. And you will see more beatings, more rounding up of the opposition, more of a crackdown on media and journalists, the few that are still able to operate within the country. You know, we've heard appalling reports about people being walked on by police and army, being made to eat their shoes, being made to do all kinds of horrible things, make denouncements about who they support in stadiums and other things. Some of this is not verified. We're in the process now of verifying this and trying to get out to the rural areas, because obviously if this is going on, it has to be exposed in the hopes that some action will be taken to stop this sort of thing. The other aspect of the human rights situation that we're very concerned about, of course, is the impunity that rules the roost in Zimbabwe. And one of our big concerns with any discussion about the formation of a government of national unity, which I think Otto and Fabienne may talk about, which is sort of out there, that there may need to be some sort of accommodation made between the MDC and the ruling party, that those who have been most abusive within the government, within the army, within the state security services, cannot be part of this government. They need to be somehow dealt with, because it will be, as we keep saying, you know, the same sort of repression and authoritarian rule. So something needs to be done on this front, and there are differing views about how to approach that. And you know, we can have a discussion about that, but at this point it may be a bit premature to have that discussion, since we don't know exactly what's going to happen in the next days and weeks. Regarding advocacy, our target, as we call it right now, is the African Union. We feel that SADC has failed completely, especially not even, of course, condemning or drawing attention to the, you know, the massive human rights violations, which continue to be the root cause of the political repression and the electoral violations and the continuity of the very bad situation for people there. That there has never been any public recognition of this by SADC, certainly not by South Africa, which we also think failed in this regard. And it's really inexcusable and shameful in our view. They are, of course, putting their own political interests to some extent in the interests of, for whatever reason, having Mugabe have a nice exit, at the expense of the vast majority of Zimbabweans. We're also concerned that if any deal is reached in a government of national unity, that puts Makoni in, who is one of the independent candidates, or the independent candidate in place, who actually didn't receive a lot of the vote, that is not actually meeting the will, the electoral will of Zimbabweans, and in many ways is a violation of their political rights. So we're very concerned about that as well in this negotiation. That may happen. We're not sure where that's going at this point. So what we'd like to see, and I think Otto may talk about this a bit more, is we'd like to see the African Union step up to the plate here, call an emergency summit, and try to address the situation in a much more concrete fashion. And we have a number of recommendations in that regard. But I think I'll stop here and let Fabienne and Otto continue.
Before you go, let me quickly ask you a question.
Sure.
If you look back over this year, it has been striking that at no point has there been a voice within the region talking about the human rights issues, even though it's clearly that provoked them to get engaged. It was the pictures of people who had been beaten in jail that were flashed around the world that caused SADC to call a summit in the first place. Do you have any experience having been watching this closely over this past year, that there's been any concern at governmental level in the region about that specific issue, the human rights abuse?
We've had some indication that there is some concern, but there will never be public statements made and public condemnations. That is not the way SADC operates. I think the bigger concern is, of course, an economic one to some extent. As you know, Zimbabweans still continue to flood over the border into South Africa, and if the situation deteriorates further, there will probably be more going over the border. That's a huge financial and economic burden for South Africa. They're also getting criticized for the way they treat asylum seekers, especially Zimbabweans in South Africa. Also, as you know, the economic situation there is really in a huge downward spiral, worse than ever, and that has implications for the entire region. So these may be some of the concerns that push SADC again to call this summit, rather than the human rights concerns. But some would argue that the fact that people are even talking about perhaps a Mugabe exit, although I leave that to others to talk about, shows that maybe they're getting a bit fed up with the constant criticism of the human rights record and the situation that is not improving in the least.
Thank you, Georgette. We now turn to Fabienne Ara. She is the Vice President for Multilateral Affairs and head of the office in New York at the International Crisis Group. She previously worked at the UN. Her last position was in Sudan, where she was the Deputy Chief and Officer in Charge of UNMISS. And of political affairs, I'm sorry, I have that written down wrongly here. And before that, in 2005, she was a fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard. Fabienne.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here. Obviously, Crisis Group shares the concerns of colleagues about the situation in Zimbabwe. As a matter of fact, Crisis Group has been following Zimbabwe for the last 8 years. We have produced a stream of reports on the Zimbabwe situation. The latest one is on the table, if you're interested. It was published just before the elections on the 20th of March, and describes the pre-electoral environment. And I think would agree with Otto that that the regional mediation has failed. As you know, the mediation objective was to produce a new constitution before the elections, and obviously Mugabe called for elections before the passage of the new constitution, which is in itself a failure. I would like to make just a few comments before I go to the policy issues and recommendations. The first comment I'd like to make is that it seems very clear now that the military is in charge of running things in Zimbabwe, and it's been the case since the 29th of March. This is the analysis that our team on the ground is offering. And there's a cabala of hardliners around Mugabe, including a number of high-level military officers. Not all military officers seem to be supporting Mugabe still, but a good number of them are. So that's that also explains, I think, the intimidation, the climate of intimidation that's going on right now. The other thing is, of course, we are very, very concerned about the possibility of violence. There's a lot of intimidation going on, as Georgette said. Over 200 army officers have been deployed around the country. War veterans have been strengthened again, and as you said, maybe other types of militias too. They've been burned houses in areas where the MDC scored in the elections, and there are acts of retributions against agents of the electoral process in some areas of the country. And we are particularly concerned about reprisals against politicians, opposition politicians, MDC and other opposition politicians. In fact, following his regional tour, Tsvangirai has not returned to Zimbabwe, and we understand he has received a number of threats. I also would like to make a comment on SADC, and although I agree with you that the communique, the press release, is very disappointing, I think there is a change still that needs to be underlined. I think it shows, the last summit shows that there are serious divisions within the sub-region. The communique was the object of negotiation, quite lengthy negotiations, between, on the one hand, Zambia, Botswana and Mozambique, and I think Tanzania as well, and on the other hand, Beki, you know, so representing South Africa, Angola, DRC, and Namibia. And we have to remember here that DRC, Namibia, Zimbabwe, Angola were on the same side of the Congo War, the last Congo War, that lasted from 1998 to 2002. They defended the Kabila regime, and so it looks like there's still an alliance, a quiet alliance there. Certainly DRC, Joseph Kabila, has a debt towards Mugabe. The second thing that I'd like to underline as far as change is concerned is that Mugabe did not attend the summit, which I think is a sign of weakness. He was represented by a number of quite hard-line ministers, but he himself didn't turn up. Antoine Giray was invited, which also is a diplomatic breakthrough. And he's now got audience with Zuma, with Gebusa in Mozambique, and with Kama in Botswana. And the last thing that I think is a significant development is the divide between the ANC now and Beki, with the government of South Africa. And that's also quite interesting to watch. Our Zimbabwe analyst, who was in town a few days ago, talked about a sunset president when he spoke about President Beki. But it looks like Beki is losing credibility within his own party, particularly over Zimbabwe. The Speaker of Parliament in South Africa also made quite a strong statement, along with other speakers of Parliament in the sub-region, expressing very strong concerns about Zimbabwe. Now, as far as recommendations are concerned, scenarios, options, I think we still need to push for publications of the results. This is really the best, you know, objective that we can all have consensus around. Once the results are published, there will be probably a push for a negotiated settlement, and I want to spend a little bit of time on that particular aspect. Tsvangirai himself has indicated willingness to consider a negotiated settlement or power-sharing agreement, and I think he does that knowing perfectly well that the balance of forces in the country is not in his favor. Although the opposition has grown a lot over the last 7 or 8 years, ZANU-PF still controls the state, controls state resources, controls the state apparatus, and most of the military, certainly high command, and has been in power after 28 years. And it has been, as you know, a very centralized authoritarian regime. So I think Morgan Tsvangirai understands that he cannot just take over and run the country overnight. And this is very sad for democracy in Africa, but this is the reality. I mean, I think the transition is starting now, as a matter of fact. And so there will be some sort of accommodation between the two parties. And that's unfortunately the case in many other African countries, that, you know, elections can, and we saw that in Kenya, elections bring a change. When elections are peaceful, like they were in Kenya in 2002, the transition still has not been properly done. And this is, and we saw what happened in the last round of elections in Kenya. The third recommendation is, as Georgette said, get the AU involved, because as we all discussed, as we all agreed, SADC is very dominated by South Africa, and we need to introduce other voices into the mediation. What's very important, and I'd like to stress here, is that the mediation has to be African-led. I can't see any third party coming from anywhere else than Africa. And I think that it would even be preferable for the mediator to be someone with an experience in African liberation struggle, because I can't see Mugabe listening to anybody else. And it would be somebody who would also be able to save face for Mugabe. And then, of course, there's a whole discussion about security guarantees. We understand from a number of corners that Mugabe and his cronies are concerned about his own security, and that he thinks about the Charles Taylor example, and he doesn't want that to happen to him. This is not being brought up at this stage, but this is certainly a concern that will have to be taken into account if anybody negotiates an exit for Mugabe. And the last point I want to make is that I think we should also push for the Security Council to consider Zimbabwe as a topic for discussion. the definition of Security Council concern is that the situation that they consider has to be have to be a threat to international stability and security. And I think we can, when you look at Zimbabwe, all the ingredients are there. There is intimidation against the opposition, with possible, you know, flight even of opposition politicians outside of Zimbabwe. There is increasing violence on the ground, and inflammatory rhetoric. There is electoral manipulation. There is an economic implosion, as George had said. Waves of migrants have crossed the borders. And they're running away from a politically engineered disaster. So they are not economic migrants per se. We can't call them, I think, political refugees either, but it's somewhere in between. And the fifth element, or fifth ingredient, is that we now have even divisions among the countries in the sub-region. I mean, the last summit showed it very clearly. So it does have consequences on of the region, and some countries of the region have already said we are concerned about this. Of course, the challenge will be South Africa, you know, which has the presidency of the Security Council. But maybe we should remind the South Africans that, you know, at the time of apartheid, international sanctions were internationally endorsed, and they helped them get out of that situation. So I think I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Otto. Looking at the situation as it stands now, what do you think is needed in terms of supporting the advocacy that the other two have suggested is needed in terms of public advocacy, in terms of pressure?
Well, thanks. I think that there are quite a number of issues that have been raised that might warrant, I think, even further discussions. One of which is the perception or assumption that after the announcement of the results for the presidential elections, chances are it will be, you know, a win for the opposition. I think we have to be prepared even for a shocking result, since the government has had so much time to even manipulate the votes, as it were, to the extent that right now ZANU-PF itself is not even talking about the idea of a government of national unity. They are going... They went into this election wanting to win, and they've delayed because they knew that they lost, and are now manipulating the recounting processes, even at the Constituent House of Assembly level, to the extent that they would even regain their majority, assuming the votes are recounted in their favor. So to them, it's not an issue of a lose. It's going in a win-win scenario. So I thought we should raise that before we look at some of the advocacy levels. I think for a start, the African Union seems to have been working, you know, in the background, taking the lead from the SADC region. But as we have said, I think there have been relative successes insofar as the SADC region has for the first time accepted, I think, the opposition in Zimbabwe. This is the first that I think Morgan Tsvangirai has ever had access to so many heads of state within the region in Africa, beyond the interactions that they have had, I think, in the US and the European Union. So it's a very positive development. But the African Union also has quite a number of standards that they have in place. They recently adopted a democracy on good governance, which stipulates quite a number of interesting dimensions around what you might call an unconstitutional change of government, where a winning or an incumbent, like the ruling party right now in Zimbabwe, refuses to hand over power to a winning party, you know, after having a free and fair election, that could be deemed to be, you know, an unconstitutional change in government. Effectively, the coup that has been talked about, the fact that we have the Joint Operations Command, which is running the country, composed of the head of the intelligence, the Minister of State Security, the head of the army, the police, and the prisons, you know, that cabal, it's actually an indication of the fact that there is some form of a coup. So it's an issue of speaking to their own standards that they have in place. Then another dimension that we see taking place is the fact that Zimbabwe is one of the countries that, you know, sticks out as a constitutional authoritarian state. They do everything by the book, you know, in terms of the law. you know, they refuse to release the results. You go to the High Court. The High Court says it's reasonable and expected of the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission to take as long as they deem necessary to verify, collect, recount the results. So if you find yourself in a situation where the law is becoming, you know, virtually is being arm twisted, manipulated, constitutional provisions are interpreted to suit the desires, you know, of the ones that are in power, it can also be deemed to be, you know, a violation of the provisions under the African Union. So one of the things that possibly could be raised is to say the African Union has an obligation, in as much as they've been waiting for the SADC-led mediation and the SADC summit, you know, to kind of facilitate dialogue and come up with something tangible. That doesn't seem to be the case. And they really now have to come up to the table to say, look, in the event that there's going to be a runoff, that is something that has not been talked about. What is it that we expect? Are we going to send in an observer mission? What type of an observer mission do you want to have in place? Even during the recount, which is taking place over the weekend, no one has raised interest issues around the fact that for the past 14, 15 days, the ballot boxes were kept at a secret location. The National Command Center was disbanded, opposition polling agents, civil society were chased away. Ballot boxes were transported in the military vehicles to an unknown location. No one has had access to those ballot boxes. And yet, civil society, the MDC, has been invited to do a recount. You know, how do you recount something that you have not been watching through the past 14 days? So these are very practical, you know, issues that have to be addressed before we even move into the stage of saying in the event of a transition, because you're going to have an electorate which feels so cheated and disgruntled to the extent that whosoever assumes office whenever the results are announced is likely to be questioned on whether it really is taking the Zimbabwean people seriously, because right now, everyone is so tired of having a government which is not accountable and responsive to the demands of the ordinary person. So if there are going to be any efforts of lobbying around the African Union, possibly those standards could be invoked. Already there are efforts by an organization to raise a petition which is going to be presented to the South African president tomorrow, and they are collecting signatures. I think right now there are about 120,000 signatures that have been collected. They hope to irritate Thabo Mbeki, assuming he gets irritated by that. You can find it at avaz.org. Yeah, that's the website. So those are some of the, I think, strategies that are likely to be of influence or of interest to some of you. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Otto, and to the others who as well. I'd like to open it up. You're welcome to ask questions, but also make comments. Just make sure you keep them short enough that there's room for other people to do it too. If you'd like to go to the microphone, just identify yourself and kick it off.
This was very depressing.
Obviously very depressed and immobilized by the presentation. Yes.
I have a question. I'm going to adjust this first. My name is Alex. I work here at OSI in the communications department. And I have a question for Otto about his experience working with political prisoners. And I'm curious to know to what extent his efforts have, on a larger scale, made a difference or an impact, not just in terms of dealing with individual situations of political prisoners, but in raising this as an issue in a, you know, in a broader field of conversation or discussion about what's taking place in Zimbabwe and how he feels that that has impacted what's happening now, or whether there's a potential for those experiences to have an impact on the process and the whether it be the stories of those people or the situation, you know, the conditions under which they were detained, and whether that as a, I don't want to say public relations tool, but as a means of telling the story or making the political situation or affecting the political situation, I suppose.
Should I take it now?
Yes, go ahead. Absolutely.
Okay. I've attended to quite a number of cases and the organization that I work with since 2003, when we started a project that we call the Human Rights Defenders Project, Emergency Fund Project. We have attended to no less than 3,000 cases of individuals who have been arrested, detained. Some have been brought to the courts, but there hasn't been a single successful prosecution and conviction by the state, which could be an indication of success on our project, but also it could be an indication of the fact that the law is just being used not as a tool of prosecution, but a tool of persecution. So you're arrested, you routinely appear in court, sometimes bail is denied, sometimes you are granted bail, you're detained for months in end. We have a case where individuals who are alleged to have petrol bombed police stations were detained for about 6 months. During that time, they spent hours in end, you know, hanged upside down in the cells, with leg cuffs tied on, you know, onto their legs and all that. Some of them have been denied medication despite the fact that they'll be having open wounds. We've had individuals who have been in custody and living positive, you know, are supposed to be getting ARVs, but because of the fact that, as you might know, the health sector is virtually collapsed, they've been having to force to miss their treatment. There are quite a number of examples that, you know, of cases of individuals that we've attended to. Suffice to say that how to best use that possibly to portray or to raise awareness on the environments that activists and political activists face and human rights defenders alike, it's very debatable. Some of the individuals are not very keen to come up in the open and say out the experiences that they've gone through. The retribution that we've talked about is one of those cases. There are also examples of, you know, women and children being detained. You have groups like the Women of Zimbabwe Arise, who even this year during the International Women's Day, you know, were beaten up and detained for just distributing roses. They are in this habit of, you know, distributing roses every time that they go into the streets. So if you have a government and a regime which becomes so threatened by the sight of a rose, you know, and beautiful as a rose it is, it actually, you know, indicates the levels of desperation, you know, that are unfolding in the country. That will be my short response. Yeah.
And has having the civil society advocates had an impact on the sort of political situation on a broader spectrum in Zimbabwe? I mean, has it affected the way that the government goes about things, or has it changed the, you know, does it create a reluctance on the part of the government to, you know, to target certain high profile people or low profile people or in general? Or I mean, is there any sort of impact on a larger scale to speak of that you see from it, or is it still so, you know, is it such a nasty political situation that it doesn't?
Well, I think if the Zimbabwean government really want, they are very indiscriminate. I'll give you a case today. The director of the Zimbabwe Election Support Network was on her way from South Africa, and she was disembarking. She was accosted by the police internal security intelligence and routinely interrogated about her relations with quite a number of US-based organizations. And she's a very high-profile person, you know. She has contacts within even the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Minister of Justice. But when the state decides that you're a factor and you seem to be, you know, blocking their way to their continued existence, they obviously target you. The manner in which they target you, I think, is the one that might be different. They might just continue with the obvious harassments, denigration in the public papers, being called a stooge, being called, you know, an agent of the imperialist, all sorts of names that are just meant to lower your status as an individual who's trying to contribute within the open space or the space that we have in the country. So it's very debatable depending on the nature of the individual in question. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next. Hi. I have about a million questions, but I'm just going to keep it to four. Fabienne, I wanted to ask... Oh, thanks everybody for their presentations. Fabienne, I wanted to ask you which state you thought would be a a good state to bring up the issue of Zimbabwe in the Security Council. And then, you know, I keep trying to figure this out, of who has leverage over Mugabe and who has leverage over Mbeki to sort of get Mbeki to act more responsibly on this issue. And then my last question is, it's speculation, but I'm just wondering if, you know, this weekend it ends up that there's a recount and that Mugabe claims 52% or 53% and, you know, it's over, he won the election. Who we appeal to and what we ask them to do. So if we appeal to the AU, what do we ask them to do in those circumstances? Thank you.
Thank you, Maggie. Go ahead, Fabienne.
Okay, these are difficult questions. Thank you for asking them.
Directing them to you.
Which state should bring the issue to the Security Council? I am not sure which state should bring the issue, but I'm sure which state shouldn't. and certainly, I would prefer to that the UK and the US particularly stay out of this issue. I think it would be disastrous. When I was working at the UN a few years ago in New York, I saw the British attempt to bring Zimbabwe to the Security Council over this eviction crisis, and it just never went anywhere. So I think that's part of the answer. The best, obviously, would be an African country. It would be South Africa or Burkina Faso. That would be my preference. So perhaps this is something that we could collectively suggest to the Burkinabes to look at Zimbabwe as an issue they could take up with the council. Who has leverage on Mugabe? I think nobody does.
John Mbeki, I think it was.
Both.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I think Mugabe is 84 years old. He is a former leader of a liberation struggle in Africa, and I think his psychology is so inflexible now that I don't think anyone can really advise him, and he would be able to listen to that advice. What I think is still probably important for him is to be part of a circle of leaders of African struggle, or former leaders of African struggle. So it probably has a cost for him to be accused by his peers of being, you know, a criminal. That I think has some weight. But unless we get, you know, the Tanzanians, the Angolans and the South Africans and many others to come together and deliver a strong message, I think he will still be able to divide and rule even among his peers. Now, if there is a recount and then Mugabe is declared the winner, one of the possible scenarios is that he may still actually be willing to talk to the MDC and even go into a power-sharing negotiation. It is the view of some of our analysts that ZANU-PF may want to have a recount so that they are in a position of strength to negotiate. Right now they are obviously in a position of weakness because everybody knows they lost the elections and they would be illegitimate to push it through, especially through violence. So if there is a recount and you know the first round says that Mugabe won, then it's possible that they would be more willing to negotiate. But it's just a possibility. We can't have any certainty about that.
Anybody else want to chime in on that issue?
Well, I think that a dimension that you would also want to have, you know, is the fact that when Zimbabwe amended its constitution for the 18th time, the idea behind the 18th amendment was to allow for the House of Assembly to then sit as an electoral college to nominate someone to succeed Mugabe without having to go through the ballot. So if there's going to be a recount and Mugabe happens to be the winner, and the very same recount gives them a majority in the House of Assembly, they can then now be able, you know, in terms of the vote, to actually manipulate a succession. And the person who was heading the delegation to Lusaka, Emmerson Mnangagwa, is the one who's been touted through and through as the likely successor. So trying to think like someone in ZANU-PF, this will be their strategy, in my view. This is what they are looking at. This is like their end game. Thanks.
ma'am.
Hi, my name is Lisa Vives. I'm with Global Information Network. And I think the effort to change the government in Zimbabwe has probably been the second largest funded effort by NGOs and other groups after Darfur. Yet, as you said, Fabienne, these reports will not impact what U.S. foreign policy is as far as being able to present in the U.N. a denunciation, or it will have little meaning because of the long history of the U.K. And the United States. At the same time, civil society in America is not really totally with you in your thinking, and I'm specifically referring to the African American community that I'm familiar with, which feels that people haven't spoken about the impact of the World Bank and the IMF, and Mugabe is the only one picked out, and nobody talks about Somalia, nobody talks about Central African Republic. So there are a number of, and DRC, as you must know, there's so many other critical cases. And so there's a feeling in the community, in the American populace, those that are concerned with Africa, that that your efforts aren't reaching them. They're not getting that word. So I'm just wondering if you consider that to be a weakness in your work, and if you would like to address that in some way, or if you've been thinking about it or have any plans. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
Directed to me or to us?
Who's going first?
Is it directed to me?
I think it's the panel in general, but I mean, I think if anybody wants to make a comment, you make. Georgette, do you want to?
Well, what I would say is that Human Rights Watch has put out, as has ICG, I don't know how many reports on Zimbabwe, which has been taken up within international media and regional media for a number of years now. We also do reports on Somalia, on Darfur, on Kenya, on every other country in Africa that's going through a crisis, a similar crisis, some might say a worse crisis. So, you know, if certain communities aren't picking that up, I think to some extent that's their problem, not our problem. The information is out there for everybody to see and for everybody to read and for everybody to get mobilized around. I don't know if you're referring to the White Farms issue or some other issue, but, you know, our view is that there's no shortage of tools, information, and efforts to join groups like Zim Lawyers and others to work on Zimbabwe outside of the U.S., or within the U.S. even. The problem is the U.S., like in many other countries, is not seen as an appropriate interlocutor at this point in time, or the country that can put effective pressure on a country to change its human rights policies for all the obvious reasons, which I won't go into.
Anyone else?
Well, thank you for your comment. I would say, like Georgette, that we have had an Africa program at the Crisis Group for over 10, 15 years almost, and that we cover absolutely every African conflict. We've had streams of report on the DRC. I lived myself in the DRC. I covered DRC, Burundi. We had, you know, reports on Somalia, on Central African Republic, political assessments of the situation that are all available on the website. But this being said, if you have any specific suggestions, I'll be happy to follow up. And you just come to me and we can discuss it further.
Well, I think, as already highlighted, that the U.S. foreign policy is not as attractive to many of us. It's not as a homogeneous concept as it were. The other dimension that we have to looking at the American community, if we put it broadly, is to try and demystify who Mugabe is. You know, if you're still looking at Mugabe as the man who in 1980 preached the reconciliation and forgiveness, the man has completely metamorphosized. You know, he's a different man today than he used to be. So that's the message that you should put across. I live up on 116th, and on 125 in Harlem, there's a guy there who has got this van, and on this van he's got a poster written Mugabe is right. So every time that I go shopping there, I always engage him. You know, I actually put plus or minus 30 minutes for him every time I go up there. In as much as we all agree about the land reform program, that it is a noble cause. South Africa is still battling with that, Namibia to an extent. You know, there's no way that we could look at possibly the economic empowerment of Africans without looking at the land reform. But there's always this dispute to say, how do you go about it? Do you have to kill? Do you have to turn your country into an empty basket? Where right now we depend on imports from Malawi. Malawi, whose budget depends on donor aid. That's where we are getting our maize from. We have him, himself, Robert Mugabe, shouting at the top of his voice to say, the Zambians and the Malawians are stockpiling our maize at the border. You know, the maize that we are importing from these countries. So these are things that have to be addressed. And you then have to turn the 500,000 farm workers who are now all over the country, internally displaced, they don't even have any source of income. Do you then have to create this racial divide? Because right now, the Zimbabwean issue is painted as if it's black and white. It's not about that. You know, it's not about color. You know, if you talk about the commercial farmers, most of them have left the country. You know, so let's demystify ZANU-PF and Robert Mugabe and expose them for who they are. That would be my response.
Thank you. We've got a queue there.
My name is Harriet, and I'm a student at SIPA, Columbia. Fabian, you talked a bit about an exit strategy with the AU for Mugabe, and I think I just wanted you to weigh more on that. What could that be, and in terms of incentives for Mugabe, putting aside the whole idea of violence, violently taking him out, what other incentives are there for him to see this as, you know, a good thing for me to do? You know, so I don't know if you could weigh on that.
You're on, I think. Yeah. They're all on.
Okay. Well, as you know, mediation processes are confidential, and I'm sure any negotiations to find an exit strategy for Mugabe will have some mysterious and secret parts and chapters. And one of them may be, as I mentioned before, that he would be allowed to leave power or leave power to a successor, perhaps from ZANU-PF, without being prosecuted for some of the crimes that he committed. I'm not saying that this is the position of Crisis Group at this stage. I'm just saying that this, of course, is an issue that has been brought up in many other negotiations of the same type. This is, you know, after 28 years in power. And a number of crimes committed, including economic, the leaders have feared to leave power. It's a reality. So this is probably going to be part of the discussion. I understand that MDC, in fact, Morgan Tsvangirai has already reached out to a number of high-level military leaders and sort of promised them or at least hinted at the fact that there would be no witch hunt if he was to take over power. As you know, these people have taken a lot of money from the Congo, for example, and also from Zimbabwe itself, and land, obviously, and they are also very concerned about their future.
But while we're on this subject, is it appropriate to ask to what extent he actually has power in this situation? I mean, is a reasonable scenario that in fact power is effectively in the hands of his security and military chiefs, and he is a figurehead, and that it doesn't really matter that much what he wants, even if he wants to step down, that they may actually prefer to keep him there and sustain him as the figurehead just because it's convenient for them, in which case the whole transition scenario starts to look a little less plausible. I'm just curious to know what you think about that.
Well, it's a possibility of course, and they are. I mean, you should speak to this. There are probably a good number of people that have interest, or that have close interest in seeing Mugabe's regime survive. But I would say that what I just said about Mugabe's security fear applies to them too. And so, if the MDC commits to not engage in a witch hunt, then it should apply to these people too.
I imagine, Georgette, that you would not be in favor of a transitional deal which would get all these guys off the hook.
Well, Human Rights Watch is never in favor of amnesties for very serious crimes. The issue here would be, what crimes are you talking about, over what period? As I've said on other occasions, the international justice part of this is complicated by a number of things. First, the International Criminal Court does not have jurisdiction in this case. So that is sort of out as an option. The other difference with the Charles Taylor scenario is that there is no international tribunal that has indicted Mugabe for any war crime, crime against humanity, or any serious human rights crime, we call them. So it's different from Taylor, who had been indicted when he negotiated his exit. That makes a huge difference, because, of course, the court was no part of that exit-making deal and could do whatever it wanted in the long run. So then you're left with justice at the national level, and we would certainly not want to see an amnesty, but some sort of accountability. And the big issue there is whether it's a TRC, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, or some other format that Zimbabweans themselves want to see happen. And I'm sure Otto has a lot more to say about that. But there has to be, our view was there, you can't just erase the past. And there has to be a historical record, particularly, for example, for the Matabeleland massacres and, some very serious crimes that did happen. So that's where that is at the moment.
Okay, well, let's have another question.
Yeah.
Thank you. My name is Hui Lu, working in the Office of High Commissioner for Human Rights at the UN. Thank you very much for the very interesting panel. I think we all are aware that the situation in Zimbabwe requires political solution, the regional and further engagement, perhaps, of the international community. My question is a little bit addressed for three of you. I think, Otto, you had paid a visit to our office last year with a group of and your friends. So my question is a little bit as we know that, have you thought about if we have them, are you considered, for example, bring the attention to the independent human rights special procedure of the UN, which is the independent human rights mechanism, whether the range of special rapporteurs are covering both the civil political rights as well as the economic social rights, or, for example, special rapporteur for the human rights defenders, special rapporteurs on the extrajudicial and summary execution, special rapporteurs on working group on arbitrary detention, special rapporteur on the right to health, right to the adequate housing, all the special rapporteurs, so they can actually, be mobilized to issue the urgent appeal to the government, to the regional organizations, even NGOs. So that's just my thought that I'm wondering whether you have, what your thought consider about this option for the immediate address of the human rights situation in Zimbabwe. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's take another question so that we can not have people have to stand for so long.
My name is William Harvey, and I run a small NGO that's done musical work in Zimbabwe. And I had a couple questions. I was wondering, what I find very fascinating is the trade-off between wanting justice for some of Mugabe and those who surround him, while at the same time hoping that they could possibly be persuaded to make an exit. And I'm just wondering, particularly for Ms. Gagnon, how do you weigh those concerns? Would you accept an amnesty, and would the people of Zimbabwe accept it if that were the only possible way of getting them out? And then also, I'm wondering just about the future, if what seems now a best case scenario of Tsvangirai being ushered into office. I don't actually know much about his past. I mean, what is the likelihood that he would be an improvement, or is it possible that, like Mugabe, he would start out speaking of reconciliation and then end up, with more human rights abuses of his own?
Thank you. Fabienne, would you like to take the first question? No, you can't. That's very clear, very clear answer.
On the special rapporteur.
On the special rapporteur?
Yes, thanks. It's good to see you again. we've thought about it, and I think the last time that we saw a joint action from the special rapporteurs was around the forced evictions. I think there were eight of them. Yeah, who issued a joint appeal to the Zimbabwean government. But what remains of concern is the fact that the Zimbabwean government is yet to accept, I think, requests by quite a number of special rapporteurs and the special mechanisms to actually go and do fact findings and investigations in Zimbabwe, which we think might really add weight to the agent appeals. There's a tendency, I think, when it comes to the agent appeals for the government, they might respond to you, but that might not deter them, I think, on the ground. It could possibly raise the international profile of the cases, but it also have to be complemented, I think, by other mechanisms. We're still very much interested, I think, in exploring that as an alternative or as an option. It has worked in the past, and I think it will also work in these instances. On the issue of amnesty, I think it's a very sticky and hotly debated issue in Zimbabwe. At present, I think it was Fabian who raised the issue of the Matabele, and they are called disturbances, but killings, effectively, where right now you have a generation of Zimbabweans who don't even have access to national identity documents because their parents, were killed during that period. You have individuals who are
20,000.
Yeah, about 20,000. You're talking of individuals who are so bitter to the extent that what they see after Mugabe is gone is just a prosecution, to the extent that they don't even know that the ICC doesn't have jurisdiction, because everyone is so excited about the fact that he has to account. So there really is going to be, I think, a need for organizations that have really worked extensively on transitional justice to really think through this, because this culture of impunity, I think, is the one that has brought us to where we are. If you look at the liberation struggle, over 50,000 people were killed during the liberation struggle. Nothing happened. It was a reconciliation. But some actually warned during that period that, look, you might be extending this hand of reconciliation, but there hasn't been any form of accountability. And it has brought us to this very same day. So I'm not really, very much for the amnesty myself. I would want to see some form of national prosecutions and accountability taking place. But also, if you look at these mechanisms that are in place right now, as a practicing lawyer for about 5 years, going to court on human rights cases on a day-to-day basis, I don't have the confidence in those mechanisms and the institutions available. The judges themselves have patently and openly professed their support for the establishment. They've gained from the land reform program. He comes to you actually with feet showing that he has been in the farm, or he's selling his vegetables outside his office. You are inclined to buy from this judge because you're appearing before him. So there's also that element to say, if you're going to be approaching these same institutions, are they capable of delivering justice? Is it going to be acceptable? So it's very debatable. The MDC, the background of Morgan Tsvangirai and the party, when the party was formed in 1999, it was formed after what was called the Working People's Convention, which was virtually a bringing together of student groups, trade unions, virtually everyone. Then I was in the student leadership. We participated in the development and the drafting of that Working People's Convention. One thing that I think is certain is the fact that once Morgan Tsvangirai at some point, whether we are dreaming or not, becomes the president. There has to be institutions that clip his powers. Some of us have vowed that we have represented him, but we'll be very quick to say, look, Mr. President, this is not what we were advocating for. So it's always important not to lapse into that phase of saying, ah, now independence, democracy, you know. Then you resign to that complacency phase. Because as they say about power, you know, the moment he has the power, I think he's likely to behave or to want to consolidate and have more of it. So it's always important to have mechanisms and institutions. That's why we are advocating for a new constitution, you know, that has in an array of the Bill of Rights and institutions that protect that. Suffice to say that as a political party, it might have difficulties, it might have challenges, but right now, Morgan is the face of the new Zimbabwe, whether people like him or not. You know, everyone who wants a new Zimbabwe identifies with Morgan Tsvangirai. You can speak to the fact that there was a splinter of the opposition, but what then happened? You know, they virtually lost in all of the elections that the constituents that they contested. After the split, the MDC led by Atham Tambara had the highest numbers of members of parliament, but right now it's the reverse. They have about 10, you know, which indicates that in as much as the opposition led by Morgan Tsvangirai might have weaknesses, people still identify with them. I'm not going to speak for him because I'm not the spokesperson for that party, but just to indicate the sentiments on the ground.
Any other thoughts on amnesty?
Just on the what you raised, William, I think your name was. The peace versus justice issue has been around a long time in conflict and post-conflict discussion, and there's differing views on whether it has to be peace versus justice or whether there can be some sort of sequencing to that effort. But as I said, certainly our position at Human Rights Watch, which we think has been borne out by the record in many countries, is that amnesties don't result in proper accountability, particularly for very serious crimes, especially when, you know, large parts of the population are looking for accountability in some form. But, you know, there's a number of models out there, as Otto said, and there are a number of groups like the International ICTJ that, you know, their job is to assist countries with coming forward with a model of transitional justice that works for them and that the, you know, the citizens and the people want, and hopefully they will get. The other thing I just throw out there is that if you look at the Kenya mediation, which was held in February, two commissions of inquiry were established pursuant to that mediation. One on past historical human rights abuses and grievances, and one on the recent political violence, which, as you know, was very serious. So, you know, that might be also something that could be put into the mix of any sort of negotiated political solution. Now, I think it's going to be very difficult to push that for Zimbabwe, given given the history and given ZANU-PF's role in all of that. But that's not necessarily a bad thing to be talking about right now. And we're certainly pushing accountability as part of the exercise of going forward. But we're not saying how it should happen or who should do it. That's up to the Zimbabweans.
Thank you very much. Let's have a couple more questions.
My name is Amel Goran, and I work here at the International Women's Program at OSI. I wanted to ask you, in terms of, I mean, this is a grant-making foundation, and we are working in Zimbabwe. What do you find are the most strategic interventions or types of support for Zimbabwean civil society? I think, you know, amidst all this chaos and repression and so on, it's the Zimbabwean civil society. I mean, there's so many brilliant examples of that, resilience and have been able to deliver a very effective opposition, but beyond and the long term as well. I mean, at some point there will also be a democratic change, no matter how long it takes, and maybe people are not in the position to prepare for that now. But what debates are going or what types of work can we support. I also have a question for Fabienne about the AU. You mentioned, you know, the division between the DRC, the countries that we're in coalition with in the DRC war, and if the mediation effort within the AU, I mean, do you see them blocking that, and if you can elaborate on some of the debates. Just one thing I forgot to mention about the civil society. For example, in diaspora or the Zimbabwean civil society or the Zimbabweans who are in South Africa, I mean, yes, they're refugees, discriminated against and oppressed. Do you see, for example, that that's a viable group to support, and could they play a role in pushing, in some ways, the South African government to act, or is that totally unrealistic?
Thank you. Yes, sir.
My name is Patrick Pierce. I'm working for the International Center for Transitional Justice.
Oh, good.
Thank you for the comment. But I work on Burma with the ICTJ. Mm-hmm. And my question is actually about the Security Council. About a year ago, the Security Council considered a resolution on Burma, and South Africa was in the friendly company of China and Russia,
exactly,
in voting no on that. So South Africa's performance on that was dismal, to say the least. But my question is actually about China. Three-part question. One is, what would a Security Council resolution actually say? Second part is, what is China's involvement in Zimbabwe? And third, what is there any sort of strategy about dealing with China on the Security Council since they have a veto? How to deal with China at the Security Council if a resolution comes forward.
So how about you kick off with Amel's question, okay, then, and we'll move further down.
Right. Thanks, Amel, for that. I think it's, at present, organizations in Zimbabwe, we are very much worried about the firefighting, if I may put it that way, to the extent that, of course, there are organizations and individuals that are starting to think about the possibility of a transition, but obviously there's the element of the capacity internally in civil society to really extensively look at that in depth. But what I would advocate or suggest is how to empower, you know, non-high-flyer organizations. You know, you've heard about Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights repeatedly, but there are organizations that are virtually on the grassroots, kind of, very small. There could be one man or two men individuals, you know, who are identified with that organization, but they are very effective insofar as community mobilization. The information which is filtering up to Human Rights Watch, even up to ourselves, mm-hmm, you know, is virtually coming from those organizations, you know, that are not very much known. And these are the entities that I think right now are in need of so much support, so that at least they are the pillar of support in their communities. You know, they are providing safe houses, you know, they are moving people to hospitals in areas such as Mutoko, which is about 200 something k's out of Harare, you know, providing contacts with the lawyers, etc. These are organizations, in my view, that have not been able to acclaim or take the limelight, and they've remained virtually working within the community, very much acceptable, very much simple, you know. But maybe supporting them might be difficult because they might not have the know-how of how to submit a proposal, you know, and to meet the donor requirements of doing the reporting, which I think we also have to take into consideration to say how then do you go about it. One of the ways that we have, as an organization, tried to assist some of these grassroots organizations is to do sub-granting. We are managing grants for about three grassroots organizations. We get the money, they implement the activities, we do the reporting, the financial tracking, everything for them. What we just expect of them is to adhere to the ideas that they've submitted and that we have then turned into a proposal. We know it's difficult, it's challenging for some organizations to have confidence or trust in the sub-granting idea, but that's how we've been trying to assist organizations that don't have the capacity to do that for themselves. Then civil society in the diaspora, or Zimbabweans in the diaspora, again, you're faced with the situation that it's not a very homogeneous community. There are some that I've met, you know, in the UK and even here, who believe that the change in the government might also entail a change in their circumstances in their host countries. So you really have to be careful, because there are some, this might sound very rude, but we have turned into conflict entrepreneurs. You know, they are thriving on the chaos that is in Zimbabwe. And for as long as it persists, and then there is a justification for them to be where they are. So I'll urge you to tread that with caution. There are also other very reputable individuals and organizations who are doing so much very good work. So I wouldn't want them to, you know, paint it with the same brush of what I've just said. Then on China, I'll respond on the involvement rather than the Security Council. I'm not really an expert on the Security Council. I don't have any clue of that entity. China is heavily, well, invested in Zimbabwe to an extent. I think in any conflict scenario or situation, we have seen the Chinese hand, you know. They've been able to provide, if you look at the transport sector in Zimbabwe, the buses, everything, they're all coming from the Chinese. If you look at some of the farms that have been taken over by Chinese entities. If you look at the construction that is happening in preparation of the spillover effect of the World Cup in South Africa, it's all going to the Chinese. They've been able to prop up, I think, the Zimbabwean regime, as they have done in the case of Darfur, maybe in Chad to an extent. So it will be, I think, important to identify their earlier areas of leverage. Suffice to say that in Zimbabwe, there isn't much to gain. We don't have any oil, thank God, I think, because we might be having several countries coming in by now, following threats that have been issued by some of the presidents, I think. Yeah. So I think it's important to look at what really interest they have in Zimbabwe beyond propping up and identification with the old communist leadership that Zimbabwe used to be. Yeah.
Yeah, let me start with China. I think I'd also say China is quite involved in Zimbabwe, but I would say that they are not supporting a dictatorial regime for the sake of it. I mean, they're interested in Zimbabwe because they have economic interests, obviously. They are interested in Sudan because they have economic interests. It's not so much that they have, you know, this philosophy of supporting centralized authoritarian regimes. And in Zimbabwe, the economic situation is a disaster. There's more than 200,000% of inflation. And I know for a fact that the Chinese are not happy with that. And they have expressed their concern many times to the Zimbabwean government about the economic situation. They did express concern over the eviction crisis also two and a half years ago. And not so much, again, because they cared so much about the rights of the Zimbabweans, but because it really creates instability in the country, and then it has an impact on the investment. So I don't think that China would be completely unsympathetic to some of the concerns that we express here about the stability of Zimbabwe. Now, as far as the Security Council resolution is concerned, I don't think we are there yet. What we are proposing is that the matter be seized by the Council, and there would be a discussion at Council level. But I think what is at stake now is the definition of the situation in Zimbabwe as a crisis. We saw it after and during the SADC summit. When Becky went to Zimbabwe before the SADC summit and came out saying this is not a crisis, and then when we saw that this negotiation over the press release lasted for so long between the different members of SADC, and that the issue was whether or not it was a crisis or should be defined as a crisis, I think this is enough of an argument to bring this debate to the Council. If the Council takes it sees it as a matter of concern, then it will mean that the Zimbabwe situation is a crisis and should be treated as a threat to regional stability. And the Council could, for example, endorse an EU-led mediation effort to broker a peace deal between the two parties. Now, as far as the EU is concerned, obviously the dynamics within SADC would be reproduced on a bigger scale at the EU. DRC, Angola, and others would probably keep the same position. But I think the idea of shifting the focus from SADC to the EU is that South Africa will not be as dominant in the EU. Secondly, we have Kikwete as the chair now of the EU, a Tanzanian president, who is rather on the side of on the other side of the equation, and quite willing, I think, to undertake a mediation to resolve the conflict. And we also have Jean Ping, who's now about to replace Konare as the head of the EU. So we have new faces in the EU, and perhaps without any guarantees, but perhaps a new willingness to do something. Thank you.
Thank you, Fabienne. And I don't know, Georgette, whether you want to weigh in on this topic, but I'm going to run for my train, and so I'm handing over the chairpersonship to
no,
you.
No, I think it was well covered. Yes.
Sure.
No, like on Darfur, what you'll get is the best you'll get is an abstention or not using the veto. So two more questions and then we'll call it a night. Or one more question over there. One more question? Two more questions, okay.
Mm-hmm. The impunity impulse.
because one of my books is called International Handbook of Multi-Generational Legacies of Trauma. And it shows in 32 populations around the world that in effect, you don't have justice, the next generation will try to get it. Most likely via violence or via discipline. So, hi there. That's what I mean. I have the impulse to talk about it tonight rather than any other night. Passover is coming. But it's because I think, here we are in the Open Society Institute, the ICTJ being beautifully represented.
Oh, it's another ICTJ.
Somebody has to do this as a serious study.
Okay, thanks for that. Thank you very much.
I strongly believe that Zimbabweans or Africans
we can solve our own problems. If we can mobilize the resources, the social capital that we have amongst ourselves, we have better access to holding our leaders accountable with the assistance of our friends. But in order for us to do that, we have to organize ourselves effectively. And one of the things you talked about the whole issue of in the West, that, you know, the Zimbabwean community in New York City is not as organized as I would like to say it, that what we are seeing today even is that the money that we are sending home is actually the U.S. put sanctions and there's not a lot of money coming in, but the money that the diaspora is sending home somehow ends up being used by the government to buy, you know, stuff from China, repressive instruments. I mean, yesterday there were media reports that there were Chinese soldiers that were seen in Mutare. And so all of these things, I'm saying that they're a cycle that, as we reflect on Zimbabwe today and the future, we have to think in the context of also the capacity and the ability for Zimbabweans to actually, the institutions, this country probably functions the way it does because of the institutions. Even if though it's not perfect, you have institutions that have people that are working in there. You know that if you get arrested, at some point you're going to possibly end up in court and you can, you know, defend whatever. But in Zimbabwe, you have judges that are being promoted.
Can we wrap up, please? Because we have one more questioner. Okay. Is that your comment?
The comment is capacity.
Okay. Thank you. So one more.
Sorry, I'm almost embarrassed. It's Graham Simpson from the International Center for Transitional Justice.
Right.
I mean, the one thing that I would like to just present is the suggestion that actually we need to stop treating the South African government as a monolith on this.
Yeah.
Sorry, as what?
Monolith.
The South African government as a monolith on this.
Yeah.
I think that there are a lot of fractures.
Exactly.
In
agree.
Process, which provide quite a lot of room for maneuver.
Yeah.
And in particular here, I think one of the strategic issues would be, in my mind, to try and see if we can help build a coalition based on the assistance of South African NGOs to find their voice on this.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly in coalition with COSATU, because the trade movement has got a good record on Zimbabwe, and it also has a newfound strength on the margin, certainly in control of the ANC, if not the southern government.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that I think Mbeki may still be sensitive to, I'm not sure quite what it says about him, but everything, is some popular action in South Africa on this. And I think that that's a very important pressure point. I'm very interested also in how we think about the crimes that we are talking about accountability for.
Yeah.
Because I'm really struck by the fact that Zimbabwe offers, I mean, there is a growing trend. The draft Truth and Reconciliation legislation in Kenya is fascinating, the way it talks about, in a sort of seamless way, economic crimes, violations of economic rights, corruption, as issues with which that Truth and Justice Commission, the Truth and Justice Commission, has a suggestion that transitional justice is an alternative to obligations of international law with an attitude to it. And I'm just wondering if Zimbabwe doesn't provide, and if we're doing enough of the documentation of this, one of the most extraordinary opportunities to define as international law some of the crimes of an economic nature in relation to forced displacement, in relation to dispossessions, that are really underdefined as priority concerns for us, and which have devastating consequences in terms of loss of life. So that's just one. And then the last thing is, I mean, at the risk of sounding too optimistic and taking a long-term view, which presumes that if not now, then at some point in the future, the government will go and there will be a transition. I'm really interested in the perspectives on what early intervention strategy we should be thinking about in terms of future accountability. And I don't just mean in terms of judicial
thank you for that. Does anyone want to comment, Otto, before we wrap up?
Yeah, well, I think...
I see you wanting to comment.
Yeah. Dominic raised very interesting issues around the work or the assistance that we have been receiving from Western states. But my response, I think, or even my comment, is to say it's in as much as this rhetoric has been said about colonizing Zimbabwe, you know, I think let's pierce beyond that. Let's look as Zimbabweans beyond that, because I don't see any reasonable leadership, assuming the US has one, wanting to colonize Zimbabwe or Britain at any particular moment in time. The fact that we've been repeatedly subjected to that propaganda, it's like the Goebbels theory, you know, when something is repeatedly said, it might end up sounding to be the truth. But even if you look at the numbers, in 2002, when we had the first presidential election that the MDC participated in, the margin with which they lost was of about 400,000 votes. That margin, in my view, was a margin of terror rather than a margin of error, you know, because look at the beatings, the violations mm-hmm. that happened. The number of individuals even who were turned away from polling stations surpasses the margin within which the ruling party won. So as early as 2002, you had everyone saying, look, something is not right. And 2008 actually gave that opportunity, you know, to say this has to come to an end. There are some things that you might not be, you know, abreast with in terms of the receipt of foreign funding. The Zimbabwe Electoral Commission Act, as in place right now, does not allow non-governmental organizations to receive foreign funding to carry out voter education. It's a criminal offense. The Reserve Bank has recently passed statutory regulations which centralizes the holding of foreign currency accounts by civil societies, organizations. So even if you open your account with Standard Chartered Bank, for instance, the money that you see in your account is a mirror of what you have. The funds are with the Reserve Bank. We have had instances of making applications for our activities months in end without an approval coming from the Reserve Bank. So you might even talk about how to channel the funds, but the regime actually is benefiting from this. You know, the funds that we get from doing the work that you're doing is actually held by the regime. It's the one that they liquidate and print at the bearer checks that we have. So you then have instances where even organizations such as ourselves, I would say we are treading on a very fine line of not being criminals, because this is a criminal act. This is an act which is in place which says you should not receive foreign funding, or you should then end up having to open accounts in South Africa, have to travel to South Africa to buy your stationery, virtually everything, or even to do withdrawals for your own money. So for as long as we have this mechanism in place, you might experience those difficulties, and we could interrogate them further. I think Graham raised very interesting points around the economic crimes. Yes, to a larger extent, I think Zimbabwe, you know, presents itself as one of the likely countries to expand the theories around economic crimes and their prosecution, assuming we are going to go the prosecution route. But there's also the dimension of how to then go to the ordinary person who was not in any way, he's not a politician. I'm talking about my father, who has just benefited from the land reform. You know, this is the tainted goods that he benefited from. Would that person be prepared to let go of that farm? You know, it's the things that are actually rising right now with all veterans, because they were told that these farms are going to be taken away. They were not the creators of this chaos, but they were actually beneficiaries of the chaos. You would also look at the fact that with the banks, they passed an act called the Troubled Financial Institutions Act, which saw quite a number of banks being, incorporated into one, and being managed under the Reserve Bank. So many individuals, shareholders, lost to that. How are we going to address those dynamics? We have recently the Economic and Indigenization Empowerment Act, very long and persuasive, sexy name. But who is benefiting from that? You know, is the very same leadership that would say would want to have 55% of the ownership in all the companies. So assuming the opposition comes into power, who will be controlling the economy? These are the very same guys. So there are so many dynamics that we can, you know, go at length to discuss, but I'll just end here. Thanks.
Okay, well, thank you very much, everyone, for attending, and thanks to the panelists. It's going to be very interesting time in Zimbabwe.